Mitchell Fox, Reel 2. One interesting thing that occurred to you when you were at Blandford was a couple of ratings were drummed out for some
Yes.
misdemeanor which they had done. What interests me about it is the ceremony itself, and I wonder if you could describe for me what happened, how the unit was prepared for the ceremony of drumming out, and what took place during it.
Well, as you say, these two men had committed a misdemeanor, you see, and they were then put in the guard room until such times as there was a court martial, and the court martial decided that they should be drummed out of the service. The whole brigade was brought to, on parade and formed a square, and these men occupied the center of that square. And the bugle major was the man who stood by, and on the word from the officer, he stripped them off every vestige of badge on their uniform, anything at all that they had to signify that they were members of this particular unit. That was removed from him, and they were left merely in the trousers and jacket in which they stood up in. And ultimately, the drummers began their tattoo, and these two men were drummed out of the service and handed over to the civil authority.
Fine. Jumping forward a little bit, one general question that interests me about the sort of identity of the naval division, and this emerges from the notes which you made, where you said that in an expeditionary forces, and I'm quoting, efforts were made to change us,
Yes.
that is to say, from a naval to a more military
Yes,
kind of unit.
that's right.
Are there any specific examples of the ways in which these efforts were made?
I think that was entirely on paper. There's no question about it. There's, like in all these affairs, there's always a great deal of, shall we say, perhaps jealousy is the wrong word. But we were a small faction compared to the British Expeditionary Force, you see, and we're a unit entirely on our own, under entirely the Admiralty rules, regulations, and whatever. And the result is, in order to join the masses and fight in the trenches, wherever we had to be, they felt, the army or the war office felt, that we should be a part of them, and they wanted to change us. But was it, I've forgotten who it was at the time, I think it was Carson, was it, who fought tooth and nail, and it was prevented. On two occasions, they tried to make us military, but we resisted that until the bitter end, and we ended up the war still being our NVR.
A couple of questions I wanted to ask you now about medical treatment of the period. The first question relates to Gallipoli, where there was a great deal of dysentery.
Tremendous. Paratyphoid.
Yes. What was the medical treatment for dysentery at this time, and how was it administered?
Chlorodine was the chief medicine, the chief source of treatment. There was so much of dysentery, I think I'd be right in saying that every man Jack on the peninsula had dysentery in some shape or form, some of them hardly able to stand, some of them very sick and couldn't stand and had to be carted off. Others, again, as I say, could hardly keep their legs because of dysentery, but they still fought on. You simply reported sick if you felt that way.
Anything
And
else apart from chlorodeine?
yes, chocolate.
Well, how were these two medications administered?
Well, you never got around to that until you got either to the sick bay or to the first aid station or to Mudras, where we had medical attention, or, as in my case, when I ultimately got to Malta, chlorodine and chocolate.
Yeah,
And that was all.
well, how were they administered?
Oh,
In what dosage and with what frequency
I
and
couldn't tell you that now. We had our regular dose of medicine. I think it was night and morning, which was a drop of chlorodine. During the day, you see, we're on a very, very light diet, and we were given a piece of chocolate, which was supposed to prevent us from continually going to the toilet.
The other medical question I wanted to ask you relates to gun wounds or shrapnel wounds on the Western Front, of which you were a target of one. What was the treatment which you experienced for the shrapnel wound which you received?
Well,
First of all, perhaps you could just do this
from the very beginning
by describing the sort of wound and the condition it was in, and then the sort of exact treatment that you were given.
Well, we were going over the top, and I was hit in the top of my left thigh with a piece of something, which may have been bomb splinter or shrapnel splinter. Anyway, my leg gave way, and I didn't realize I'd been hit because I was in no pain. Picked myself up and fell again. The leg wouldn't support me, you see. And someone came over and said, you're hurt, son. And he saw the blood running down my trouser leg. And they called an ambulance man, and I was taken off to the first aid station where Surgeon McCracken saw me. I ought not to say what I'm going to say now, because I'll not appear in print. If you shut it off, I'll tell you. Then you'll please yourself whether it was whether it is something you want in.
So what treatment did Sergio McCracken administer?
It wasn't what he did, it's what he said. At any rate.
Go ahead.
Well, he said, you are a lucky fellow. I said, how is that, sir? Well, he said, if you'd had an erection at the time, he said you'd have lost your cock. So that was that. And he cleaned up the wound, and he said, we'll have to shift you off, you know, because that'll have to come out. So I was moved then down to the base, and from the base I was then sent on to the hospital at Périplage, Le Touquet. That's Duchess of Westminster's place, where it was mostly staffed by, what do they call them? VADs.
Yeah, let's get to the treatment. This is what I'm particularly interested in.
Now, when I got there, of course, all very nice, very kind, and so on and so forth, and the treatment, to the best of my knowledge, after X-ray, was almost entirely hot fomentations to the leg to pull out the pus, because it was oozing pus continuously. I mean, the thing had carried in dirt and trouser leg and what have you. And the result was, their idea was to get the pus out of my leg. Mm. But they tarried about operating, which they never did, for some obscure reason at all, because they thought it was in a very dangerous locality, and they never did operate. And whether the piece is still in my leg to this day, I never found out. It may still be, but they never operated.
Did the wound heal under this treatment?
No. I had these fomentations, and they nearly took the skin off my leg. And ultimately, as I was still losing pus and still unable to get around on my legs, I was then sent to England, and I was sent to the Stoke Military Hospital in Devonport. And the same treatment went on there. But of course, there was a demand for beds, and as time went by, I was beginning to get some use into my muscles, and I was able to get up and with sticks or crutches walk around. And then I was moved off to an officer's convalescent home in Buckfastleigh, bigger than house, Buckfastleigh. So there, my treatment stopped, you see, and by which time I was very cheesed off, and by this time I was able to crawl around on my legs, and I got around the medical officer there by saying, now, I said, look, I'm not all that bad, and I'm sure you need this bed of mine for someone who's much more serious than I am. What about getting a little convalescent leave? Jolly good idea. And he gave me a chit with that on it, and off I went up to Dunoon in Scotland, where I think, as I told you, being fond of the sea, in it and around it, I stripped off and got behind the rock, took everything off except my bandages, went into the sea, and left the bandages on my legs damp dry. Never took them off. In 10 days, the sea had done what the doctors had failed to do. It had got from my wound all the unpleasant infection and pus and so on, and to this day it's as good as ever it was.
Yeah. Could you answer a rather general question next, pertaining to the conditions as they affected you, both in Gallipoli and in France? How would you describe the main differences in the operations in the two theatres? What struck you about the difference in character between the two campaigns?
Well, in the first place, of course, the Gallipoli was a very hotch-potch affair. We were particularly short of most things, including supports and reserves of men. Conditions were very, very difficult there because of climate and because of, there was no organization, you see. Our aim was to get a pitch on the peninsula and retain it. And it was a question of push and shove from the very beginning. You went forward and you dug a trench, you lost it. You went forward again in the night and you took it again. And you were continually getting, having a battle with the Turks over this little matter. And we never did, despite all the pluck and everything else that the men obviously showed, we never did get very far. Our goal was at Chibaba, in our case. We were on W Beach, but we never got there. So we never got very, very far. And the damage, the casualties were terrific, both with sickness and with wounds and so on.
And how would you make the contrast between this experience and your experiences in France?
Well, if I had my choice, I'd rather go to France. I'd rather do the French affair over again.
Why?
Because of the conditions that existed on the peninsula. They were simply deplorable. You see, you had nothing arranged. There was nothing arranged for you. There was neither camp nor hut nor anything. You simply burrowed like rabbits, and you dug your own trenches. You rarely ever got a bath unless you went down at the risk of your life and jumped into the sea, which we did occasionally at great risk. And we ultimately had a Greek canteen on the W Beach. I don't know that I mentioned that in my notes. I'm not sure whether I did or not. But this canteen was run by a Greek, and sometimes we'd buy things from him until somebody spotted that he was using a lamp and he was signaling to a Turkish boat somewhere or other, you see. And he was court-martialed and shot. However, that's by the way. But the comparison, well, they're odious. The conditions in the Gallipoli Peninsula were deplorable. The heat, the cold at night, the germs, there was no water available except what the ships brought over, which they distilled. It was very, very limited. The heat was intense. Our equipment was inadequate. And the fighting, well, it was terrible.
Right, I'm going to make you jump forward a few years now to discuss this period in 1918 after you were taken prisoner by the Germans. Could we start that off by you explaining to me what happened immediately you were surrounded by the Germans and you came into contact with them?
We had pushed forward as far as we possibly could until the fog came down and we were literally obliterated. We couldn't see a thing. And then the Germans arrived suddenly out of the fog, no indication they were coming, and they surrounded us, completely surrounded us. And of course we were a very small body and we were shot to pieces. And those of us who remained alive were taken prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. Mm-hmm. And then I told you about the German officer who was most gentlemanly and kind. And
right.
Well, I was picked up by two Germans, two young Germans, who carted me back a little way under rifle and bayonets, and out of the fog came this German officer. Of what rank I know not, I think he was a fairly high-ranking officer, who immediately greeted me by saluting and clicking his heels and saying, "You are an English officer?" I said, "Yes." "Have a cigarette," was the first thing he said, offering me a German cigarette, and I said, "Have a real cigarette," and I offered him a packet of Tufts.
What sort of cigarette had he offered you?
A German cigarette. It was three parts tube, cardboard, and very little tobacco. The sort of thing that you'd get in a German canteen, but the sort of thing that you wouldn't buy in a shop today. And I thought, well, here we go, let him have some real stuff to show that we've got the real stuff. And so I offered him a Tuff cigarette, which was a very good Virginia cigarette in those days. And he was so pleased when he mentioned, it's an English cigarette. I said, "Keep the packet," said I, and that was that.
Yeah. Shortly after this, you sampled the German coffee.
And then he said
how
to me,
that?
"My men will take you back, you see, and you will have a cup of coffee." And they took me back to the first possible trench, and sure enough, they put on some coffee, which was an ersatz, not a coffee. It wasn't coffee at all, but it was a drink, for which I was grateful. And that was that. And then from then on, I was moved back over land, you see, while this battle was raging, and ultimately found myself in Belgium.
Mm-hmm. There was one occasion, I believe, in which a German sergeant took
a fancy to my leggings.
Took a fancy to your leggings.
Well, he did. Somewhere in Belgium, I know not where, I was asked to sit down on a stone, and I sat on the stone while one of my guards went off, and reported my coming to someone in an orderly room not very far away. And this sergeant, this German sergeant, or sergeant major, whatever he was, arrived, one of those blustery type of fellows, you know, throwing his weight about a little bit. And he had some papers and a pen with him, and he was writing down things. And he suddenly said to me, "Take your boots off, I want those." I said, "You're not going to have them." "Come on, take them off." I said, "No, sir, you're not going to have them." He said, "You can have mine." I said, "I don't want yours."
"Why not? What was the difference between two pairs of boots?"
"The German boot was the little one-third of the way up, just past your ankle, the scruffiest sort of thing that they wore, the German lads. I had a nice pair of field boots on, you see, that laced halfway up, and then another thing around my thigh, and around my calf, rather. Mm. A very nice pair of field boots, and I wasn't going to part with them. I was rather proud of them. However, he became offensive, and he looked as though he was going to strike me. Before he could do so, there was a yell from the order room, and a German officer appeared, and I thought he was going to strike the sergeant. Mm. He gave him a good rousting and ticked him off and dismissed him, and then he apologized to me.
Now, as you were travelling back through the German lines, did anything in particular strike you about the condition of the German forces?
Only that they were very young soldiers, the German. They were very young indeed. It almost seemed as though they'd come to the bottom of the bucket at that time, and those that I did see were very, very young. And the older ones all had jobs well behind the lines and were obviously past fighting.
Now, the first POW camp you went to in Germany was at Rastatt.
Rastatt.
What was the composition of the people at Rastatt?
The prisoners, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
The prisoners were English, French, and Russian.
I'm particularly interested in the Russians. What kind of impression did they make on you?
Very sad and doleful they looked. They had obviously been there some time, and apart from the thing I told you about the wonderful chapel, which I saw that they had built, and the interior decorations were so marvellous, that was about all I could tell you about the Russians. They were very fed up and very doleful, very sad about the situation.
Mm-hmm.
The French...